you know, if I had one sort of piece of advice to other people or to, you know, even to myself, it's to spend as much time as possible on mindset and to the extent possible, stay away from the attraction of focusing on like logistics or how do I get something done. And if you have 10 minutes, spend 8 of them on mindset and 2 of them on logistics. Whereas I think maybe like typical American culture is to spend the whole 10 minutes on logistics of like, well, how do I get that done? Or that's impossible, or that's going to be too hard. But if you spend 8 minutes on mindset, those last 2 minutes will just go like a breeze and you'll figure it out. And that's available to all of us. We all have that power.
If there's anything I've learned from my time caring for the seriously ill, it's to appreciate the extraordinary gift of this thing we call life. Hi, I'm Dr. Kathy Zhang, palliative care physician, author, and speaker. And my goal is to bring the clarity, purpose, and meaning often found at the end of life to help you live your best and most fulfilling existence now. I truly believe everyone on this planet has a purpose, and it's my mission to help you filter out the noise and discover yours. Let's get started.
Hello. Welcome back. It's another week, so you get another episode. It's kind of hard to believe that summer is almost upon us, isn't it? I mean, we had a mini heat wave here last week, and I stepped outside and I was like, oh, I am not ready for this. But sometimes, I guess, in life, we're not ready for things, and we have to face them anyway, right? So I'm just going to prepare for summer. And I guess that's a metaphor for life, isn't it? Anyhow, this week, we have a very special guest. Her name is Dr. Elaine Stogeberg. This interview is so special. And I know I say that each and every time, but I really do feel that. And I'm grateful that every guest brings something to the table that is so insightful, so unique to them and their story. And you know, I'm here just to share their stories and extract the lessons from these remarkable people so that you and I can apply them to our own lives, because there's something to be learned from everyone's story. And Dr. Elaine's is no exception. I mean, I was tearing up at one point, and I know I'm a crier, but I don't always cry during podcast interviews. So this one is really touching, to say the least. So just a little bit of background. Dr. Elaine Stogeberg is a psychiatrist, mother of 4, and owner of Black Swan Real Estate. She is a physician. She is a master of health administration and owns and manages a portfolio of, get this, over $200 million in assets under management. Through real estate investing, she reached financial freedom in her 30s and now helps others do the same. Black Swan has delivered exceptional returns to hundreds of passive investors through their unique investor-focused private equity funds, which enjoy no sponsor fees whatsoever, 100% return of capital to investors before any splits, and long-term tax advantages, all coupled with socially conscious investing and at least 5% of profits donated to charity. Connect with her at meetblackswan.com and take a listen to this interview. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Purpose Filter. We are super lucky to be joined by Dr. Elaine Stogeberg. She is a force of nature, and I do not say that lightly. So I'm super excited to have her here. Welcome, Dr. Elaine. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. So how are you? I know you have a newborn at home. Is that right?
I do. Yep. He is 7 weeks old today, actually. Happy 7 week birthday, which is such a sweet time because he's starting to smile and his eyes really work. So he's able to look at me and smile. And it's just it's all a fun journey with a newborn, but I feel like particularly this week has been really sweet.
That's awesome. And for our listeners out there, this is not her first child. This is your fourth?
This is number 4.
Number four. So does it feel different this time around or each time?
It does. So for me, my first baby was my hardest. I'm sure some of that was you know, my own lack of experience, and some of it's just her temperament. My husband and I joke that we're very lucky that she was our first, because maybe if we had known better, we wouldn't have kept going. But we were just like, well, this is what it's like to have a baby. Like, I don't think I set her down for the first 3 days of life. She my husband and I were like passing her back and forth. And on like day three, I'm like, we have to set her down for just like 20 minutes. I need to just relax. And I'm just like, oh, that's motherhood. And then each child after that has been easier, which leads me to believe that part of it is that I'm maybe becoming a little more laid back. Could be coincidence that their own temperament is a little easier, but I have to think that since it's a clear trajectory, it maybe has more to do with, you know, my own style with them. So I have a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and then my baby. And each time they're very different. They're very similar in a lot of ways, but they're also very different. And I would say what has been most rewarding is seeing the older children interact with the baby. You know, my 6-year-old, like, she knows that she can make him, the baby, smile, and she's engaged with him and trying to make him smile. My 4-year-old, like, you know, kind of gets in his face and tickles him, and maybe isn't as skillful with like handling a baby, but is still very interested in him. And then even my 2-year-old will sit next to him when he's in his swing and just say, "It's the baby, it's the baby." So like each one of them, there's a little relationship there. And that is so rewarding. You know, all the sleep deprivation and everything, seeing them interact is so rewarding.
And hearing you, you know, we had spoken previously, like off camera, you know, off audio, about kind of how you manage everything, because you have 4 children under the age of 6. You're running a profitable, successful business. You're very, very busy. And I think a lot of people out there who are balancing and juggling things are always like, how do I make this happen? How do I do it? You shared some tips with me about your mindset and some of the more practical things. Do you have any of those tips to share with our listeners as well?
I would say the big change for me was when my second son was born. I had my maternity leave. I was very lucky to have a 12-week maternity leave. And then when he was 15 weeks old, I was back to work and I fell and broke my ankle. And that required me to essentially not be able to walk for about 4 weeks. I had surgery and then a cast and all of that. And that instantly necessitated help, because I had a newborn baby, a 2-year-old. I was working, but I was on like a leave, and my husband was working. And so we just asked one of the teachers at my oldest child's daycare if she would be willing to come over several nights per week and just help with like meals and dishes and kind of holding the baby, those sorts of things. And that was such a pivotal shift for me, because I was forced to sit essentially in a chair. I was able to move a little bit, but it was very challenging. And I did a lot of thinking, a lot of reading. I made a lot of friendships of just calling people and just building, you know, I had all this like quote unquote free time on my hands because I was in a chair. But to loop it back to your question there, I was able to see the power of outsourcing. And since then, I have outsourced as much as I possibly can. And I do that both in my personal life, but then also in our business. And it's been so powerful to see what are the things that uniquely I can do and uniquely I can bring value to my family, to my business, to the universe that the world needs me to do. And everything else, is there a way to outsource it? And then over the last maybe like 6 months or so, I feel like I've taken that like to the next level. And I think I heard a saying that Elon Musk said on something, I don't remember exactly what, but something I heard him say was, don't optimize a process that doesn't need to exist. And that was like very eye-opening for me, because I had been focusing so much on outsourcing, which is good, but you still need to manage outsourcing, right? If you have, say, a lawn company, you still need to make sure they're coming and that they're getting paid and that they're doing high quality work. And eventually, you know, you might run out of ability to outsource because of the finances that are needed to do it. So that's a limitation in both personal life and business life. And so now it's more of, well, what can be cut altogether? What's something that no one needs to do, or how can we really automate something with a process instead of a person? And I'm very new to that world. I don't claim any expertise there at all. But the little improvements I have been able to make with that new mindset have really helped. And then just being able to add on more things in the business, more children, more things in the family, and then just constantly asking myself and everyone around me, what can just be cut altogether? And then if it can't be cut, who is the best person to do it? And what are the things that I uniquely need to do?
Right. And it, you know, I think I read that you had said in an interview that about a book called Essentialism, which I read years and years ago. And that was one of my first kind of forays into all of this. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is amazing. And I love that quote, don't optimize a process that doesn't need to exist, and kind of just filter out what is actually important in our lives. Right. And then go from there. Okay. That's nugget number one.
Yeah. The sequel to Essentialism is Effortless by the same author, Greg McKeown. Yes. It is also very, very good. I highly recommend it.
I haven't read that yet, but I do follow him on Instagram and all of these videos where people are just doing shortcuts. They're so genius. And he just puts effortless over it. And I was like, okay, I have to read this book. Okay. So I wanted to circle back a little bit because I love stories. I love hearing about how people came to be. So I wonder if you could kind of tell us, how did this version, this current version of you, kind of come to pass? Like, is there a kind of superhero origin story? From what I understand, you and your husband kind of grew up in families that struggled financially. Is that right?
Yeah, I love the way you frame that question of what is this version of me. I think a few years ago that would have been very confusing to me, and today I understand that a great deal and really just embrace the idea that, you know, we're all living the best version of ourselves, or we aspire to live to be the best version of ourselves, and we can always keep improving. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. My husband and I both came from, you know, what I would consider to be pretty challenging childhoods. So my father was addicted to alcohol and then later became addicted to opioids. There was a period of life that I lived with him for about 5 years, but other than that, I lived with my aunt and uncle because he was in prison. And then I was emancipated when I was 16 because I knew that I was 16 when I was living with him. And I mean, we both knew that he couldn't care for me. And so it was kind of a mutual decision that I would seek emancipation. And then my husband had a similar situation. His father was never in the picture. He was raised by a single mother, and she had had a traumatic brain injury when he was 5. And that really kind of reset everything for her. So she struggled with employment and even, you know, basic economic security, all of those sorts of things. And when we met each other, we talked about these things very early on. And I think that was a big part of our attraction to each other, is that we had some sense that we understood each other and understood where we were coming from and had a clear vision that we wanted different for our lives. And so there was this connection that maybe we could create that together. And I think as we've gotten older, we've talked a lot about our childhoods and the struggles, and, you know, they're similar but different in that his mom really loved him and really wanted to be a good mother, but physically was really not able to. And my family, the years that I lived with my aunt and uncle were years filled with a great deal of love. And I was taught things like right and wrong, and that I was valuable, and that school was important, and kind of all of those things that a child needs to do well. And then the years that I lived with my father and my stepmother, those were very stressful because of the addiction, but I knew that my dad loved me a great deal. And so my husband and I were able to articulate in the early part of our marriage that we wanted to really shine the light, that the love that we had from our families, and find ways to shed the challenges and to kind of rewrite the narrative. So we got married when I was 25, and that, you know, we started off with our talk of our 4 children. That's been a big value of ours, is having a lot of children and just having the opportunity to share the love that our families had for us but doing so in a way that's very different. And a big part of the reason we want to have a lot of children is because we're essentially alone. So I've never really met my mom. My father passed away. My husband never really met his dad. His mother is still with us. She lives about 2 hours away. She's very, very ill, but we are able to see her and have a relationship with her, and the kids are able to see her, but there's no cousins or anything like that. No aunts and uncles. And so our kind of long range life plan, if we kind of get it all our way, is that we'll have a lot of children. And even if they only have, you know, zero or one or two children each, that our grandchildren will have cousins and aunts and uncles. And so we're kind of rebuilding our family tree is the phrase that we use with each other.
I love that. I love that. And the term that I wrote down while you were talking was rewriting the narrative of your family, your history, this kind of, a lot of times I think about kind of intergenerational trauma and how we, if we get our heads right, if we can overcome limiting beliefs, if we can build businesses like you have to be able to provide that for our children. And this, what I envision, like an army of Stogbergs, just, you know, somewhere in Minnesota, just like having your little enclave, right? Or family farm or something like that. But I think that's really so inspiring to be able to have that from your childhood to then use it as leverage to be like, this is what's going to push us. Because it sounds like you and your husband have a very strong purpose and a very strong why.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, thank you for recognizing that and for saying that. That's like the ultimate compliment. So that really means a lot to me. I think one of the struggles I have today as a parent is balancing that I want my children to have kind of quote unquote everything, or to quote unquote not have the struggles that we had, but then also really recognizing that I'm the person that I am and that our marriage is the way it is because of these struggles. And so how do we balance giving our children enough struggle so that they grow and become strong and develop, you know, their own inner sense of who they are and why they exist and what their purpose is in the universe, but maybe a little bit less struggle than we had to go through? That's kind of the ultimate question, I think, of maybe the next, you know, 10 or 20 years of my lifetime, is how do I take the good of my childhood and strip away as much of the bad as possible, but really recognize that a lot of the good comes from the bad? That's kind of some oversimplification of the words there, but I think it gets the point across.
Right. It's like our past experiences have made us who we are today, for better and for worse. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, I think a lot of people who grow up in struggling environments as a child or challenging environments, they look around and they think like, okay, well, this is it, right? Like, how did you as a child or as a, you know, teen look around and be like, you know what, this is not what I want for myself and for my future? Can you identify, looking back, certain aspects that, or factors that helped you propel yourself beyond the life which you knew as a kid?
Yeah, that's a good question. And as an adult, I'm able to look back and kind of interpret things through my adult mind. I don't know how true these things were at the time, right? Mm-hmm. When I was living with a younger brain. But some of the things that I really remember are, I have a very vivid memory of being in kindergarten, and we drove past a bank every day to get to school. And my brother would read the time. It was like one of those, like, you know, signs that displayed the time and the temperature. So my brother would read the time and I would read the temperature. But I had this like deep feeling every time I saw that bank that money was really hard and that grownups had to deal with money. And so the moment I turned 18, I was going to kill myself. Like, I just like knew that as a 5-year-old. Like, I didn't have a sense of like, oh, I need to die today. Like, I saw the adults in my life dealing with money and they were miserable, but I at least knew that, I mean, blessedly, we were never homeless. We never truly didn't have enough to eat. There were things like, you know, social welfare programs and Section 8 housing and, you know, food shelves and those sorts of things. But it didn't get so bad that I thought as a 5-year-old, like, I need to end this. But I just had this clear sense that adults deal with money and therefore I don't ever want to be an adult. And then as I got older, you know, when I was 12, 13, 14, all of a sudden 18 didn't seem so far away, right? I'm like, well, maybe this plan of suicide at 18, maybe I don't actually want to do that because I'm getting awfully close to that. And so I would look around and I would see that many of the adults in my life were making poor decisions and were unnecessarily suffering. And not just around money, but that's kind of a proxy that I'm using here in the conversation to speak about that experience I had when I was in kindergarten, because I would look at the bank and just feel this sense of dread. But it instilled in me this idea that maybe some of the decisions that I was seeing being made by the adults in my life led to unnecessary suffering. And there was a chance that I could make different decisions and perhaps save myself from some of that suffering. Some of it was economic suffering, like spending money on drugs instead of housing. Some of it was just interpersonal suffering, like my father had 5 siblings and they were always at arms with each other, of yelling at each other, calling each other ugly names. This was, you know, back in the day when you couldn't just like block someone on your cell phone. You had to change your phone number, and they were always I never knew what our phone number was because we were always changing the phone numbers. And I just remember thinking, like, you guys are like in your 40s, 50s, but probably 40s by then. And you clearly have been doing this for like 40 years with each other. And you know that changing the phone number is not going to help. You know, you're going to be talking to them tomorrow. So just don't change the phone number. Like, just like cut out of that like suffering and like move on. And then that really, you know, I wanted a different future for myself. I wanted to go to college. I wanted to have a good career. I didn't exactly know what those things meant, but I had friends that had older siblings or their parents that, you know, had experienced those things. So I had some glimpse of what it might look like. And so that's why I went to my dad when I was 15. And I said, I really don't think you're raising me very well. And I really think I'd be better off alone. And I think you know it too. And I think I think the best thing you could do for me is to let me leave. And I think it's tough. You know, I've never had a child of mine say that, but I can imagine that hearing that from a child would be quite tough. And he could have dug in his heels and said, you know, no way, you have to stay here, you're my kid, those sorts of things. And instead he signed the paperwork to allow me to be emancipated. And so I was also able to leave at a fairly young age. So I left at 16, and that allowed me to have kind of a pre-adulthood before sort of real adulthood, where I was able to sort of work through a lot of the trauma of my childhood at a pretty young age.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, just hearing you recount all of this, it's so, I don't even know what the word is that I'm feeling, but it's just remarkable, because I know from, you know, doing my research and all this stuff, like what you've been able to build with everything that you have, even in residency. You know, you trained in psychiatry, and then with your business now, I think you guys have 130. How much do you have under?
We're actually up to $200 million.
$200 million mm-hmm. under management, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just freaking incredible. So, I mean, hats off to you and your husband for just being able to make this. And it's not the money, right? It's about,
that's right.
I know you are very, you know, heart-centered, you're mission-driven, and we'll talk about that later, but the money is a symbol of the impact that you're able to provide for other people. I'm really wondering, you know, I know when I speak to a lot of people who've overcome challenges, that sometimes there are moments in their life that, like, seminal moments or something that just kind of is so life altering that it completely changed the trajectory of their life. Does something in your life come to mind when I bring that up?
It does. Yeah, absolutely. So you know, I shared there about my childhood and about leaving at 16 and, you know, having the ability to work through a lot of the trauma of my childhood and even just, you know, abbreviating some of the trauma by leaving at such a young age, right? That was those fewer years that I had to be in that chaos. And I was very lucky that going all the way back, even at like age 3, age 4, my father was in prison. So I was required to have like a court appointed therapist. So I had therapy at a very young age. I was very lucky that I always did really well at school. So I had great relationships with my teachers. And then I did therapy as a young adult, went to a very great undergrad where, you know, I got not only a great education, but I felt like I was really raised in that environment. But kind of all through this, particularly in those years after I was emancipated, I still had some relationship with my dad. I went to an undergrad that was just like in my same hometown because that's just kind of all I could envision as an emancipated young person. So I would still see him and it reminded me of the years where he would be changing phone numbers with his siblings. It was kind of that we'd maybe have like a few good weeks and then there would be some sort of blow up or something, you know, no doubt because he was intoxicated. And kind of all through it, I had this sense of like, well, I'm going to show you like, well, I just got into college. You never did college. Or, I mean, I graduated high school. You never graduated high school. I got into college or, you know, I'm working 3 jobs. Like you never could do that. Just kind of this like, just a grudge for lack of a better word. And no doubt that damaged our relationship, right? And the relationship was so frail to begin with because he was so ill, right? From the substance abuse and the addiction. But what relationship was there, I didn't know it at the time, but there was this huge wall between us because I had this feeling of, well, I'm successful just to prove you wrong. And I kind of carried that on. And it harmed both of us, right? It maybe at the time felt good to me, but I was really like tarnishing my own accomplishments because I was making them this like vendetta instead of just an accomplishment for accomplishment's sake. And I was no doubt hurting him that sure, he didn't graduate high school. That's probably because he also came from a very challenging childhood with a father who was addicted to alcohol, a mother who had schizophrenia and didn't have the benefit of all the therapy that I did. And so he, you know, went into the arms of alcohol at 14 or 16, whereas I went into therapy. And so right after I got married, my husband and I went to Utah for a 3-week trip the summer before I started medical school. And we did a lot of hiking. And I learned that when you're hiking with someone for weeks on end, you run out of things to talk about. So a lot of those hours of hiking, we were just in complete silence. And that was really like probably the first time in my life that I really had an experience like that. And we were in Canyonlands National Park in Utah, which is not a very populated or popular national park. And we were hiking. We'd probably been hiking for about 4 or 5 hours. And I was in this canyon. And anyone who's been in a canyon knows like the cloud and the sun drama that's happening and all the sound, all the, you know, acoustic interest because of the canyon walls. And I just had this moment of complete clarity. I'm kind of a religious person. I'm kind of not. So, you know, kind of depending on how someone might think of it, like maybe it was the hand of God, or maybe it was a stroke of the universe, divine intervention. I don't know what, but I had this sudden and very deep sense that I was not successful to spite my father, but because of my father. And here I was about to go into medical school, which was this accomplishment that was just like completely outside of the scope of my imagination. Like in my father's generation, no one had finished high school. And all of the cousins, I think there were like 12 of us, myself and one other finished high school. No one else did. So I had finished high school and then undergrad. And then in between, I had earned a master's degree. And now I was going to go to medical school. And it dawned on me that all of that opportunity was available to me because of my father, and that he didn't have the resources that I had. He didn't have a court-appointed therapist when he was age 3. He didn't have all of the resources that I had in good public schools growing up. He didn't have the mental health help that I had available to me as a teenager. And it took me until I was 25 to really figure it out. But despite all of his flaws and what I now know was just illness, despite his substance abuse illness, he really loved me. And even with all of our, you know, challenges with communication and all of those things, I knew that he loved me. And in that moment, I realized that because he loved me, I was able to believe in myself and to believe that I was capable of going to college and capable of getting married and capable of going to medical school. And I don't know that he had that, anyone that really believed in him as a child. And he was missing that piece. He was missing that protector. And I thought about it on that hike, and it really didn't, the instant happened like in a millisecond. Like, I'm explaining it like 10,000 times longer than it actually took to happen in my brain. And I planned to tell him when I got home from that Utah trip. And I thought a lot about what I was going to say and how I was really going to, it was going to be a line in the sand in our relationship. And I, at the time, I was living in Oklahoma City. That's where I went to medical school. And I got home on a Friday night at like 2 a.m. We drove home, and my brother called at like 10 a.m. that morning, and I didn't answer it because I was pretty tired. And my husband was going out with his friends to, I don't know what, like wash their cars or something. And he said, "I think you should call your brother back." And I was like, "Well, why?" And he's like, "I don't know. I just think you should call your brother back." And I did. And as, you know, as soon as my brother picked up the phone, he told me that our father had passed away. That like probably like as I was arriving home from Utah was about the time that he was passing away. He died of an opioid overdose. And I never did get to tell him that huge change that I had had. And I think, you know, it took me many years to really be at peace with it. But I think it all happened kind of exactly the way it was supposed to, that, you know, really my last, like, you know, quote unquote memory of my father, I was in Utah by myself. He wasn't there in the memory, but it's this memory where I'm like in relationship with him. It's kind of like the most perfect last memory someone could have. And it has given me so much freedom to really live the life that I want to have and to build the family that I want to have and the career, and to just keep coming back to that deep feeling that it's because he loved me and because he, you know, he tried and he just didn't have the resources that I had. A lot of it was, I was just born, you know, 30 years later when there was a better understanding of child abuse and child struggles and mental health. It's a big part of the reason I chose to be a psychiatrist was to treat the younger versions of myself, treat the younger versions of my father. The freedom that came from that epiphany has really been life-changing. I think if I was the person I am today and I had never had that freedom, maybe I'd have the same level of success like on paper, but certainly not in my heart, not the feeling I'm able to have of enjoyment and just having a purpose in life instead of feeling like, oh, well, I'll just show the world what I can accomplish, or, you know, I'll just kind of be the best or whatever. Instead, it's very much a, what was I put here to do? What's my purpose here? How do I contribute to the universe? What does the universe need from me? Yeah. And then all of my children look like my dad, but one of my children in particular looks a great deal like my father. My father had hazel eyes. My son has hazel eyes. My other three children have blue eyes. And that is a surreal feeling. And I don't know where, you know, I fall on the woo-woo spectrum or what I believe in terms of souls or those sorts of things. But every once in a while, maybe once every 6 months or so, I'll have this feeling of like my son is a version of my father. And this is my chance to do it right with less suffering.
Wow. Wow. It's a good thing we're actually not going to put this up on recording video, but not putting any of this up because I'm a mess here. I've been like trying, I've been like quietly just dabbing my tears as you talk. First of all, I mean, oh my God, thank you for being so open and vulnerable and sharing about this, because, you know, I can't imagine what you must have felt then, what you must feel now, just recounting that to me, to whoever is going to hear this. And I, doing what I do, I was fairly woo before, but I think it's way, way more so now that I do this work. There's so many things that we just cannot explain, like how you had that epiphany and when you came home, and like this, almost this ritualistic, profound act of forgiveness, it sounds like, at the probably this coinciding moment when your father was, I don't know, having his experience as well. And what strikes me hearing you talk is also this string of quiet moments in your life when you were hiking in Utah, when you had your injury, and all the thinking and the connection to yourself, that like things become clear when you're in one way forced to be quiet by your injury or forced to sit on the sidelines. And on another aspect, you chose to do that by, you know, submerging yourself in nature and that sort of thing. I think that's something that we find too in our work, is just the silence allows people to have the time to be able to reflect and find the clarity that they were hoping to have. But when there's too much noise, it's almost impossible to do so.
Mm-hmm. I think we live in a world that is just very chaotic. You know, for lack of a better word, there's just so much stimuli as compared to, you know, even our childhoods, right? We didn't have cell phones, and, you know, maybe there was one or two televisions in our homes growing up, but you know, I don't know how many screens are in my house right now, probably at least a dozen, and just constant pings and this and that. And even the streams of communication of maybe someone texts you and then a different person calls you and a different person emails you. And then you have this thing on a calendar and whatever. I certainly find that as I get older, I long for silence more. And I think if someone had told me that, you know, even as recently as like 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't. I would have said, oh, you know, I like it, but it's, you know, it's not, I'd rather maybe be with friends or whatever. And now I think about what are ways I can purposefully carve out silence in my daily life and my weekly life, leading up to the delivery of my most recent child when I was maybe about 38 weeks pregnant. I checked into a hotel, like literally just like 3 miles from my house, like nothing fancy, nothing far away. And I checked in at the earliest that I could check in. And then I paid for like a late checkout. So I was in that room for 24 hours and I didn't do anything. I turned off my phone. I turned off my computer, the television. I drew the curtains. So I had nice, or I'm sorry, opened the curtains. So I had nice sunshine coming in and I was just completely quiet. And I just felt like that was what I needed before I brought another child into the chaos of our lives. And even just thinking about it, I just feel so good about how good I felt after that 24 hours of complete silence.
Right. It's like the where you see moms just like lock themselves in the closet or in the bathroom, or just like, I just need a little bit of time to myself just for my own sanity's sake. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm also wondering too, the mindset that you have had to kind of really forge in order to be able to accomplish the things that you have. Because I find that that is something that really is the biggest key. You know, a lot of people say like mindset is 80% of success. What have you found or thoughts or anything that's really helped you overcome challenges in business, in your personal life, that you feel you'd love to share with our audience to help them be able to do the same?
I think for me, the first part is really just believing what you just said, that mindset is so critical. I can imagine times even in my own life, and I can put myself into, you know, what I think is the perspective of others and maybe think like, well, that's a crazy statement, or must be nice to say that, or maybe you don't understand my struggles, or it's not that easy. But really it is. really it truly is. And I think an alternate story that I certainly tell myself that I would maybe encourage someone else to think is, what if it is that easy? What if it is possible that mindset can be so powerful? Because it's something that all of us have, regardless of where you are, regardless of how old you are or your circumstances or how much money you have or how many resources you have or, you know, professional success, whatever, we all have mindset and we all have the ability to change our mindset in an instant, right? Like I described that story with my, the change in heart I had around my relationship with my father, and that happened in an instant. Now, no doubt there were years of therapy and talking and growing that led into that instant, but the actual instant happened in one instant. And we all have that power. And so to me, that is so empowering that, you know, I call it like the human superpower. We are all born with the superpowers of mindset. We are all born with the superpowers of visualization, of seeing a future and finding a way to get there. For some of us, it is easier. It's hard to visualize a future if you've never seen it, right? I was able to go to medical school because a physician believed in me. I worked for her and I told her I wanted to go to medical school. And she said, well, why didn't you go to medical school? And I said, oh, you know, people of my background, they don't go to medical school. People like me don't do that. And she spent about a year just really telling me, like, I believe in you. You can do this. If you want to do it, you can do it. And so I had to life-changing, right? A life-changing relationship. So I had to borrow from her visualization until I could make it my own. But really just believing in mindset is so powerful. I found myself in the Tony Robbins ecosystem about 3 years ago now. That has been so powerful for me. You know, the stories that he shares, the stories that people in his ecosystem share. There's common themes of, one of the phrases kind of relating to the story of my childhood that Tony says is, what if the worst day of your life was the best day of your life? And I don't have like a specific day like that, but I'm able to hear that and to think, you know, what if this quote unquote terrible childhood was really a perfect childhood? What if it set me up for everything I needed to have in adulthood? And, you know, many of the stories and things that Tony shares. But, you know, if I had one sort of piece of advice to other people or to, you know, even to myself, it's to spend as much time as possible on mindset and to the extent possible, stay away from the attraction of focusing on like logistics or how do I get something done? And if you have 10 minutes, spend 8 of them on mindset and 2 of them on logistics. Whereas I think maybe like typical American culture is to spend the whole 10 minutes on logistics of like, well, how do I get that done? Or that's impossible, or that's going to be too hard. But if you spend 8 minutes on mindset, those last 2 minutes will just go like a breeze and you'll figure it out. And that's available to all of us. We all have that power.
Yes, 100%. And that's something that I love as well, you know, and I'm in the Tony world is also, but I think it's just something that you said was so profound is it was one instant that essentially changed the trajectory of your life. Like you said, a lot was leading up to it, but literally that one moment, and we all have access to it. We all have this potential, this innate power, as you said. And that, like you said, is so inspiring because what if everyone else can do it, if they can apply it in their own lives, why not us? And you, I know you say this too, like if Elon Musk,
if Elon can get us to Mars, then I can run a real estate company. I say that to myself probably once a day.
I love that. Like if this person can run a country, I can do the laundry and get dinner on the table or whatever it is.
Yep.
So, it was a really great reminder for me as well. Like, why not us? Right. Mm-hmm. Like if they can do it, why not you? Why not me? Why mm-hmm. not us? Okay. I love that. As we're wrapping up, I did want to ask if, because you have such a strong sense of purpose, such a strong why, and it just radiates through you. And I know maybe some people out there are listening like, man, I would love to have that. you know, I have no idea what I want to do. I'm so lost. How do I get there? Okay, yes, focus on mindset. Is there anything else that I need to think about or consider to be able to have a strong sense of self and purpose and why?
That's a really good question. For a long time, I had a sign on my door that said, "Life is the story you tell yourself." And again, that's one of those things that sounds so simple, especially when maybe there is struggle or depression or even just a sense of angst of, you know, one might say, I'm burnout at work, I'm taking care of my aging parents, and I'm in a high cost of living area, and everything's just really hard. That's a story at the end of the day, right? Instead, someone might be able to say, I feel very blessed that I was able to train in the profession that I love to do. And maybe this particular employment situation isn't great for me, but I have the opportunity to find something else. And how lucky am I that I get to take care of my aging parents, or I'm kind of making up this like caricature in my head. And, you know, how lucky am I that I get to live in a high cost of living area that a lot of people want to live in, maybe where there's access to the ocean or mountains or, you know, something like that, that makes it attractive to people. And one is a very disempowering story and one is a very empowering story, and it's the same person, right? And we all have that available to us. And to be clear, it is easier, right? Like I didn't give stories from my own life there. I made up this like fictional character in my head because it's so much easier to rewrite the stories of someone else. But if we can do it for someone else, then we can do it for ourselves too. And I'm always just reminding myself and reminding the people around me, because it's hard work, right? I don't want to give any false belief that this just comes easy peasy. I think for most of us, it's hard work. But if there's a story to be chosen, choose the empowering story. We get to make up what our reality is. There's a set of facts that we agree on, that we, you know, have to agree on. What is the temperature? It's 72. You might say that's cold. I might say that's hot. Neither of us are wrong. Those are stories that we're telling ourselves. We have a fact that we, you know, base that off of, but we have the option to choose an empowering story and just keep practicing it.
Mm-hmm. And I want to remind our listeners, Elaine is a trained psychiatrist. She isn't just like any person off the street. Like, she has a mental health background. So this is all rooted in training and science, and it does make sense, right? So I did want to bring that up because you do have expertise, even though right now your focus is mainly on the business and things like that. But it's so true that our lives are, the world is the way that we see it, right? And the stories that we tell about it. And that's how I think about life a lot as well.
The most empowering thing for me as a psychiatrist was when I changed my own paradigm of how I treated my patients. And this is in the therapeutic realm, medications, you know, a little bit different. But there was a time when I just decided that my number one goal for any session I had with a patient was just to tell them how amazing they were. And not in this flippant, like woo-woo 1980s, everyone gets a trophy kind of way, but seeing their innate power inside of them and reminding them of it. So really, and then it became almost like a game with myself of what I could come up with and how I could find the beauty in another human being. So I would be on like hospital rounds of, you know, maybe someone was there that, you know, had just attempted suicide. Maybe they had, you know, tried to wreck their car into a median in a highway, like a really dramatic, you know, kind of terrible thing, right? And this is the morning after, and I'm there on hospital rounds trying to get a sense of who this person is and how I can help them and what's going on. And I'd be thinking about, you know, what am I going to say when I meet this person? Because I would get report from nurses and stuff, so I'd have some sense of what the story was. And I might say something like, you know, Joe, the kind of person that has the courage to drive their car into a median at midnight on a Friday night, I believe that's the kind of person that has the courage to change their life. And if you are willing to believe that with me, let's make a go of this. Let's see if we can instill that belief in you and help you see what I see in you, which is a courageous man. When I started doing that, my love for psychiatry skyrocketed. And I really believe that for many of my patients, that might have been like the first time that they heard something like that. I mean, that's like the conclusion of it. There's kind of nothing more to say there. But maybe, you know, for any of the caregivers or physicians that are listening, I think if we can offer to the people around us, whether it's in a professional setting or, you know, just a family or you know, friends, if we can offer to people around us the power and the beauty that we see in them, then they can borrow that belief from us and hopefully see it in themselves.
Mm-hmm. And as you tell that story, I think about what you said about your father, right? Like how maybe there weren't enough people in his life that were able to tell him that. And you were able to do that for your patients, for the people around you. And in my field, we talk a lot about caring for ourselves as the best way to impact others, as the best way to help others. You, by, you know, working on your mindset and working on the business too, being able to provide incredible, safe, stable housing for all of these people, that is the extent of your impact on them as well. And I think about that a lot as how can we fill our cup, not selfishly, but because once we're good, all we want to do is to be like, how can I make you feel good? How can I relieve your suffering? How can I, you know, solve this problem for you? And if all of us can do a little bit of that for ourselves and then to others, like the ripple effect is just incredible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't see myself, you know, running a real estate investment business in my lifetime. You know, I went to medical school, I went to psychiatry training. And along the way, my husband and I were investing in real estate just for our own financial freedom. That was such an important part of what we wanted for our marriage and for our family. And then that just kind of snowballed. And then I started helping other investors. And I really saw that I was able to make the world a better place to live in the most tangible sense of the word, in housing, in where people lay their head at night and the memories that families create and how important good, stable, clean, safe, well-managed housing is. And now I really see I have this very unique role. As far as I know, I'm the only psychiatrist that owns a property management company in the country. And I think that it gives me a unique perspective in that before medical school, I have a master's degree in health administration and policy, which is from a college of public health. So all sorts of things about social determinants of health and how the environment affects health and the built environment. And I'm just bringing together this love of real estate, this love of investing, but then this medical knowledge and this understanding of the human condition. And what can I do to change property management? What can I do to make it so that rental housing is better managed? It empowers people. It allows people to have freedom and flexibility. It, for the people that want it, it helps them to promote into home ownership. How can families have stability? All sorts of things that I think I have a unique perspective. I feel very guided by the universe, that I was guided to this place to do these things. And it's so enjoyable that I get to work with investors. So I get to work with physicians and other, you know, high income professionals and take the skills that I've learned as a real estate investor to help them earn passive income, which can help them with, you know, cutting back in their work or finding more meaning in their work or more time with their family and all of the, you know, what you said, the ripple effect there. And then using that capital to make communities better. Like I couldn't imagine a better way to just spend my time all day. It's just, I'm kind of in the center of creating good on one side for investors and good on the other side for the residents. And I can't believe I landed myself in the middle of it. And it just feels so good. I feel so guided to this place.
Mm. Everything that you said there just kind of gives me chills because I think of purpose and all those things in a very similar way that like, once you feel that you're in this flow, when you're like guided by the universe, these seemingly unrelated aspects of your life, everything that you've done seem to make sense in this kind of pocket, right? Your experience doing health administration, your leadership skills as a psychiatrist and team building, you know, your childhood experience with housing insecurity and Section 8 and living in you know, places that perhaps weren't the best of living environments to the point where you are now, where you're this person who is a psychiatrist who owns a property management company and all this stuff, being able to affect change that the way that you are and deriving so much internal like gratitude from it. It's just this cycle, this kind of win-win-win-win situation. And it's so beautiful to watch from my end as well when I meet people who are there. It's really incredible. So thank you. I think that's a great place to pause for today. I thank you so, so much for your honesty, for your insights. If you're still willing, do you have a couple of minutes for our final few questions that we ask all our interviewers?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
I love it.
So the first question is, do you have something in your everyday life that you find beautiful? Something ordinary that just really lights you up?
You know, I kind of gave it away in the beginning there when I spoke about my newborn son and his smile. But certainly having been through the experience of raising four children over the last 6 years, I find newborns to just be so beautiful. And I find that being around babies makes me a better person, because it is impossible to be upset with someone and envision them as a baby. It has been so powerful for me. I will literally say in my head, like, this person was once a brand new baby, helpless, brought into the world, in need of love, in need of connection. And maybe right now I don't like the way they're behaving, or we're in some sort of conflict, or they just cut me off on the road, or whatever. But just reminding myself, going back to that, for me, the visualization is really powerful, of seeing everyone as a baby.
Mm. Okay. I'm going to try that.
It's a little weird, but I think it works.
It's a little weird. I'm definitely getting vibes of like their full adult face on a, you know, I'm going to see that on a newborn baby, but I'm definitely going to try it, because I think that's actually a really beautiful way to reframe things. Okay. Second is, perhaps what's something that you've always wanted to do, but you've been either too afraid to do it? I'm not sure that fear, from everything that I've heard from you, is something that you have an issue with. If not, then perhaps would you be able to share with us, let's say, something on your bucket list?
Yeah. So I really want to summit Mount Rainier.
Oh,
I do. So my husband and I got engaged there, but we only went up to Paradise Lodge, which I believe is at like 9,000 feet. So it's where you can drive. So we drove up and then we kind of hiked around up there a little bit, but we didn't summit. And it's, you know, because we got engaged there, it's a very special place to me. And you mentioned, you know, maybe I don't have fear. I have a lot of fear around falling and that sort of thing, because I broke my leg, right? So I broke my leg falling on ice. And ever since then, I've never quite been the same. So I want to summit it because it's emotionally special to me from the engagement. And then now it's like even more important to me that that happen, because I wouldn't say PTSD, that's a little strong, but the feeling I had ever since my fall, where I don't feel as physically secure, I think, you know, anything I can do to remind myself of my physical strength is very, very important. So hopefully I summit that in the next couple of years.
Oh, that would be awesome. That would be so amazing. I'm just thinking about it now. Do you know how tall Mount Rainier is?
It's about 14,000. So not that big in the grand scheme of mountains, but
it's
very... very doable.
That's a hike though. It's okay. That's amazing. I love that. And finally, what does a life well-lived mean to you?
I think a well-lived life is one where I come into communication with the universe as often as possible about what I'm meant to do that day. And you can imagine that if, you know, I hope that I live to be over 100 years old. I hope that we're young enough that science really advances, not just how long we can live, but how long we can live really well. And if I can come into contact with the universe for just even a few seconds every single day, or even just once a week, like that's a lot over the course of 100 years. And So I mentioned things like, if you have 10 minutes to do something, spend 8 minutes on mindset, and how, you know, we both talked about how valuable silence is, how valuable the stories we tell ourselves are. So those are all opportunities to get into communication with the universe. And maybe for someone else, maybe that's a religious paradigm. I think it's all basically the same, right? It's like two sides of the same coin. And I find that when I do that, if I spend the effort to get into communication with the universe, then the rest is very easy. That, you know, back to that, like if you have 10 minutes and you spend 8 minutes on mindset, 2 minutes on logistics, the 2 minutes of logistics will come so easily because it's your internal sense of intuition that's just guiding you. And when your brain is free to do that, it doesn't pick up on the like, well, that's not possible, or there's not enough time for that, or that's too challenging. And so I spend, you know, a lot of my time just really trying to hear what the universe wants from me in any given day. How should I guide myself? What does my marriage need? What do my children need from me? How can I be the best business leader? How can I serve our investors? How can I serve our residents? How can I make the community a better place? What do my friends need from me? Just if I deliver to the universe what the universe wants, the universe will deliver to me more than I can ever possibly imagine. And I think that that's true for all of us. I think we all have the ability to communicate with the universe or God or whoever that is. It's a practice. It's just like going to the gym. We just have to practice that communication.
Mm-hmm. Mm, so beautifully said. And I totally agree 1,000% about this interconnectedness is what I'm hearing you talk about. Okay. Amazing. Yeah. I'm like kind of at a loss for words just because of how awesome this talk has been.
It's been a pleasure. I've had a blast chatting with you. Thank you.
Thank you so, so much. Where can our listeners find out more information about you?
So our website is meetblackswan.com. That connects you to the website about our real estate business, our newsletter, our Facebook group. I do one-on-one calls with investors. I love to hear from investors and really hear about our investors' stories and what they're looking for in their lifetime. So you can schedule a time on my calendar to talk about investing or life or kind of anything. I just love to connect. And that's all at meetblackswan.com.
Awesome. Yeah. And I can vouch for that. Elaine is so, I don't know how you do it. You're so generous with your time. But again, I think it all kind of makes sense speaking to you. And after listening to this interview, I think you'll understand why as well. Elaine, thank you so, so much for taking the time, sharing your wisdom, sharing everything that you have. It has been such, such a pleasure. And I thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know that interview may have been a lot of information to digest, but also in the best way possible. Am I right? I always learn so, so much from these interviews, and I frankly feel very, very lucky that I'm able to do it and share it with you all. So thank you for listening. Thank you to Dr. Elaine for spending the time with us. Some key takeaways for me are, number one, leaning into the quiet and using that time to connect with ourselves, with the universe, with God, whatever we believe in. Number two, the power that we all have to rewrite the narrative of our lives for ourselves and for future generations to come. Number three, mindset, mindset, mindset. And number four, how our lives can truly change in a single instant. There is work, there's buildup to get to that point, but it's one connection, one decision, one thought, one action. That's all it takes to completely alter the trajectory of our lives. Life is the story that you tell yourself, so choose the empowering one. And finally, if you have any interest in learning more about Dr. Elaine's real estate fund, go to their website, do your own homework. I have zero financial incentive or relationship in sharing this with you, but I know a lot of people are trying to diversify given what's happening in the stock market. So go and do your research. And as always, take care of yourselves and take care of each other. I'll see you next week.